Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, I'm Catherine May and welcome to the Wintering Sessions, where authors talk about the cold seasons in their own lives. This week, I'm delighted to welcome Raina Wynn, writer of The Salt Path and fellow Southwest Coast Path enthusiast. We had a few troubles recording this session, so we ended up having to dive onto Skype after a series of false starts. But we finally found a line that would record both of our voices. It's not perfect, but I hope you'll enjoy our conversation as much as we did.
Yes, you too, Catherine. It's been ages.
It's been really ages. And we have had trauma with the tech today. So thank you for sticking with me. We met because of our shared love of the Southwest Coast Path, really. I think it's fair to say we were put on a panel together.
Yes, we were, weren't we, at Budley. Is it 2 years ago now?
It must be 2 years ago. Yeah. So it feels like a long, long time ago. So we both had books out at the same time. Yours is much more famous than mine. I will put that out there straight away. But you are the author of The Salt Path, which is such a beautiful book about your journey around the Southwest Coast Path after you were made homeless. And I really love to talk about that today. But first of all, I'd love to ask you, because you live in Cornwall, what's Cornwall like at the moment under lockdown? How's it all going for you?
It's actually gone quite well for me because I think I'm very suited to a life of isolation, actually. So it's just been Moth and myself here where we are in a very, very quiet spot where maybe one car has passed per day and then a girl with a dog that we look out for every morning at 11 o'clock. And that's been our lockdown. So, and we're still here. We're still more or less still isolated in the house.
Yeah, it sounds very peaceful. I think I'm in a slightly busier coastal town. We've had loads and loads of tourists come in the last few weeks, and it's been quite troubling, really. Just the beach being absolutely packed and full of kind of huge groups of youths. I've reached the age now, and I look at them and I think, oh gosh, youths, they're drinking. I like to think I'm the only one that can drink on the beach, but apparently other people do it too. And yeah, it's been peaceful for a long time, but now it's not peaceful, and that's been been quite intimidating, really, because it's hard seeing lockdown just disappear. But I'm glad it was lovely where you are.
Yes, it's been the same here, I think, out in a wider world. I think same issue has been going on here. But but for us, it's carried on being quite quiet. So very lucky.
Well, that sounds like heaven. You've chosen the right place to live. So let's talk about The Salt Path, which is the book that massively made your reputation. I'd love to actually talk a little bit about that later, because I think it must have been really hard for you to suddenly have that explode in the way it did, and for so many people to feel so passionately about it. But first of all, let's talk about the book itself. And I know that you'll be great at telling the story of it, but two things happened at the beginning of the book that began your journey. First of all, Moth, your husband, became ill, and you also lost your house at the same time. Can you take us through that?
Yes. It was, if we go back a little bit further than the start of the book, really, it probably puts it more into context, really. I met Moth when I was a teenager. Moth, my husband, when I was a teenager, I was 18, and I was in the college canteen and looked up across the room and just saw this young man in a white shirt with dazzling blue eyes dipping a Mars bar in a cup of tea. And I thought, yeah, that's the one for me. And weirdly, he turned out to be, because he's still here. But we sort of had this dream that we would find a ruin somewhere in the hills, and a place that we could restore and create a home and a way of life that would be ours entirely. Mm. And that's what we did. By the time we were about 30, we bought a ramshackle old place in the hills of Wales. And we spent the next 20 years of our life restoring it. And we kept sheep and hens and grew vegetables and two children. And it was like the perfect life, like the idyllic life.
It sounds absolutely idyllic. Yeah,
absolutely was. It was what we imagined it would be, and we had it. But then sadly, at the same time, we had a dispute, a financial dispute, with a lifetime friend that ended up in a court case. We served with an eviction notice from that home. And
that's not idyllic at all.
No, that is not idyllic, and it was absolutely devastating. And at the time, we thought probably the worst thing that could possibly happen to us. But then during the week that we were given to pack up and leave the house, so a week of trying to pack 20 years of our life into boxes, then during that week, Moth had a what we thought was going to be just a routine hospital appointment, and it turned out to be anything but, because he was diagnosed with corticobasal degeneration, CBD. It's a neurodegenerative disease that has no treatment, no cure. So just in that 1 week, it was as if our entire lives had been wiped out. Everything that we'd worked towards, and the whole future that we imagined, just gone in a week.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, how life can come at you like that sometimes. It's never just one thing. It seems that these things come in terrible, terrible clusters.
Oh, yes, don't you find that? It's never one thing at a time. It's always everything.
Everything at once. But, I mean, for you, kind of, I always think that both sides of your sense of security were hit at once. You know, your sense of home and financial stability, which is, you know, seems trivial when you talk about Moth's illness in comparison, but it actually isn't, is it? Those things can be incredibly undermining.
Absolutely, because your home is everything that you sort of structure your life around, isn't it? You create the format of your life, and it encompasses your home. But then for Moth to become ill as well, that was doubly
That's terrifying. Did they give a kind of time period that they're expecting him to?
Yeah, so at the time that they said we'd probably be lucky if it was 2 years, and most of that would be a rapid decline into poor health, really. So
Terrifying. And from nothing really, from him seeming completely fine, you were given this vision of this future that you couldn't quite comprehend.
Absolutely. I mean, he'd had a problem with his shoulder, and we thought it was because he'd fallen through the barn roof. And we were expecting him to say, well, it's ligament damage and we'll just sew you back together and that'll be that. But then it wasn't. So,
yeah,
it was an absolute shock.
So reading from that, you packed up the whole house.
Yes.
And then what?
Yes, we got the whole house was packed. It was the very, very last moment. The bailiffs were knocking at the door, waiting to change the locks. Oh. And we were hiding under the stairs. It wasn't that we were hiding under the stairs thinking some miracle was going to happen and we weren't going to have to leave. It was just we weren't ready. Weren't ready to take that very last step over the threshold, just knowing that we would never, ever go back. Mm. And just hanging on to that last minute of some kind of security, normality, safety, call it what you like, I don't know. But it was in that moment that I spotted a book in a packing case that hadn't gone out of the door. And it was Mark Warrington's 500 Mile Walkies. It's the story of Mark Warrington as a young man who walks around the Southwest Coast Path with a dog that he's borrowed from a friend and a rucksack that he borrowed from someone else, and walks what he seems to describe as 500 miles of the Southwest Coast Path. And just in that moment, that horrible, desperate moment, it just seemed like the most obvious thing to do. Just fill a rucksack and go for a walk.
Have you always been a spontaneous kind of a person? Because I'm not, and so I can't imagine making that decision at that point.
Spontaneous? I don't know. Maybe there was always something of that in me somewhere. I don't know. I looked up, I saw Moth that first time, and I just knew I'd be with him forever. Other odd little moments in my life, maybe spontaneous. But I was 50, for goodness sake. How spontaneous almost it was at 50, not very. But just then, there, everything had gone. You know, the whole construct of our life had gone. It was the last moments, the last threads of hanging on to some sort of normality. So I think then when you take everything away, then anything becomes possible. And maybe even if you're the biggest planner in the world, which I think I'd probably become quite a planner, then you can change in those situations. You can just become something else without even planning to do so.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So let's talk about the path, because we both know it intimately, you more than me, because you slept along the way. What were your first impressions? What were those first few days like of walking?
Well, I think you've been there. You know what it's like. I think you can plan as much as you like. You can read the guidebooks, you can read other people's blogs, but nothing compares to when you get there and you stand there in Minehead and you look at the start of the path and it heads up that cliff through the woods. Yes. And you realise just how steep it is. How difficult it's going to be. And you stand there and you think, what on earth am I doing?
I mean, you tend to think that walking is fine. Like, you think, I can walk anywhere. And the Southwest Coast Path very quickly tells you that you can't walk anywhere, that actually it takes you hours to get a mile sometimes. And it hurts so much.
It hurts from the first step to the very last. It's just pain. But it's about getting used to the pain, isn't it?
Yeah, you get used to the pain and you develop techniques, I think, don't you? I mean, I became a better walker, but it took me a long time and I just hated it for quite a while.
Yes, that's it. You're absolutely right when you say you think you can walk. Well, we all think we can walk, don't we? And you might just go for a casual 10-mile walk at the weekend and feel great. But when you put that rucksack on your back and you head up that, it's a roller coaster, isn't it, that path? It's you. Literally, sooner have you climbed up onto a headland than you back down to sea level again. And absolutely, that just goes on and on all day, every day. It's really...
And it's often raining while that's happening. I mean, let's be blunt. The sun does not shine on it for a lot of the year.
Well, we were. I don't know how, whether you would describe it as lucky or not, but for quite a large proportion of our walk, it wasn't just hot. It was intensely hot. It was a year when it was climbing up to about 38 degrees some days.
Wow.
And you know, on the north coast, there's hardly any shelter after you get sort of past Crevelli. It sort of becomes just bare headlands, and there's hardly any shelter, so it was tricky in parts, that's for sure. Certainly an awful lot of dehydration going on.
I was the opposite. I was you know, experiencing kind of flooded paths and lashing rain and wind. It seems that it gets you either way.
Well, we did have some storms. We had some incredible storms, and that path, when it gets wet, it becomes like it just turns to sort of slime under your feet, doesn't it? You could ski along it. It's very tricky to walk when it's wet.
I mean, there's a very real risk of falling down a massive cliff into the sea for quite a lot of the time, I think.
you could fall into the sea. There could be a landslide, and you could carried into the sea. You could be blown into the sea.
So many different ways it could get you.
So many ways.
I'm fascinated by why I love it so much, and you do too, I think. I mean, we're being negative, but
absolutely, there's something so magnetic about it, though, isn't there? I think there's something after a few miles, after a few days, that path starts to draw you along, doesn't it? There is something, like I say, there's something magical about being on that strip of wilderness. So separate from the ordinary world on one side and that endless horizon of the sea on the other. It's like you're trapped in a world apart.
It feels very otherworldly, and you're not far from civilization, because you never really are in the UK, I don't think, but it feels like you step into a different world, and it's so utterly absorbing and beautiful, but also so physically hard, and that absorbs you too. I'm really interested to know how it helped you to process what was going on being on that path. Did it take your mind off things, or did it let your mind go on to things, as it were?
It's a strange thing, isn't it? We started out thinking that we would have lots of time to think, lots of time to talk through how we'd come to that point and how to, you know, formulate some kind of future going on. But we found we didn't really talk about anything much at all, other than, you know, where we were going to sleep that night, or where we'd get the next bag of noodles. it became almost like a meditation. I think when you've walked for many hours, it becomes a matter of taking the next step and the next step. And each step becomes a success, doesn't it? Each headland that you manage to get up is a battle won, and it becomes your entire focus. And I think that empties your head in a lot of ways, and it stops you thinking, because life becomes really immediate. It becomes about, really literally, about that next step. And I think that in itself has the ability to allow your brain to calm. It allows the panic to subside, and something far more elemental to take over. And I think the salvation was in that, actually.
I can imagine how it would be incredibly comforting. I mean, it puts you back into contact with survival in a different way to the way that we understand it in an everyday sense. You know, you really do feel like you're battling the elements. But there was, for me, this feeling, which I think is exactly what you're describing. And I always thought that that was because I was walking alone most of the time. But obviously it happens when you're walking with someone else too, that maybe a few hours in every day, my mind would go into this incredibly quiet space where there weren't even any words left anymore. It was just, yeah, I was just walking. I was just existing. And that, I think, is a very difficult place to get to in any other way.
I think you're right. I think that's why I describe it like a meditation, because mm-hmm. that's what you're looking for when you meditate, don't you?
Yeah.
So I think that's that element of complete disconnection from everything. But in that emptiness, anything can come, can't it? Anything can come. And I think because after hours, you stop thinking. As you say, you stop thinking, you stop considering anything, and you just be. And there's an incredible sense of release in that.
Yeah, I always say that I would never have come to my autism diagnosis if I hadn't been doing those walks. It was like that. It opened up a kind of forum in my mind where I could accept a completely new idea about myself. And I needed to get past my conscious self to get there. You know, it opened me to new possibilities.
Yeah. I think we've taken away everything material, more or less everything financial. Mm-hmm. All the day-to-day ordinary problems of life had gone with that as well. So we weren't concerned about, you know, had we paid the council tax or, you know, did we need a new wheel on the van or whatever. All of that was gone. And our lives had gone to a far more, just a mode of survival, really. And it was down to a really basic base level of food, shelter, water, warmth. Mm. Those being the only things that we needed to concern ourselves about.
And you were literally kind of pitching a tent and sleeping along the way. How was that?
Well, wild camping, because we just couldn't afford a campsite, basically. And so to wild camp was the only way we could do it. To start with, it was really, really hard, not only just for Moth, because he was struggling just to get in and out of the tent every day, but really hard to find somewhere to put the tent, because, as you know, and a lot of the path, you can't find a flat spot anywhere. You'll see some perfect campsite at lunchtime, but by the time sort of 7-8 o'clock at night, when you're thinking, I've really got to stop now, I've got to stop, you're on a slope of thistles and gorse for the next 3 miles, and you can't possibly stop at all. So just finding somewhere to put a tent every day was an endeavour. Yeah. And I've got to say, you know, when we started that walk, I really always thought I'd be somewhere near public toilets or something.
There's no toilets. There's no toilets. There's no tea. There's no shops.
No shops when you need them. There are never, ever toilets when you need them. And so dog walkers became my nemesis because they get up too early. Yeah. Always there when you were trying to rush in to get out of the tent first thing in the morning. There is always a dog walker outside. But then there was something else really about that wild camping. And I think that was that element of never really knowing where you were going to find yourself.
Right.
Because often by the time we got the tent up at night, it was getting dark and you weren't really 100% aware of where you were. Right. So often you'd wake up in the morning and you'd find that you were in this... Once we woke up and we were in this like magical little meadow where there were millions of ladybirds just hatching into the And then other days, the day we woke up on this wet, foggy headland in a field of cows. But the sun started to break and it was lifting over the horizon and just lighting the headlands one by one towards us.
Amazing.
And we could just hear the seals calling to each other in the cove below. You know, I think that's what the wild camping gave us more than anything, was that real immersion in in nature, that real sense of not living alongside nature, but really as part of it.
Yeah, and I feel like it probably let you do it in the way the path wants you to walk it, in that it's, you can't predict how long anything will take. You know, you can use any formula for crossing contour lines on a map that you like, but I never ever walked at the pace that I ever expected, and I constantly downgraded my expectations of how far I was going to get, and I still routinely didn't make my point that I was planning to finish. And it seems to me that there's a real wisdom to doing what you did along the path, which is just stopping when you need to stop, you know.
Yes. Well, we had to, really. It was the only way, especially with, you know, Moth's illness. Some days we might only walk 2 miles and we'd have to stop and put the tent back up. Other days, you know, as time went on and we got a little bit stronger, maybe we were lucky if we did 10 miles a day. Mm. So people constantly say, oh, what was your average mileage?
Oh,
I didn't have an average mileage. And people will say, yeah, well, didn't you do sort of 3 miles an hour? That's standard walking speed.
There,
well,
no chance.
There is no standard walking speed, is there, on that path?
No. I mean, quite often I was walking for like an hour and a half and realised I'd got less than a mile, particularly in Heartland. That was the bit that really got me. Yeah.
We used to say, if we're doing a mile an hour, we're doing well.
Yes, that's so true. But then I kept seeing all these incredibly fit pensioners come yomping past me and people running it. For God's sake, people run the path.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, super fit people yomping by. Yeah. But luckily, usually in the other direction, so that's fine.
So yeah. By the time you got to the end of your journey, what had changed for you? What had the walk put in place for you, and what world were you looking towards then?
I think not only had we changed in so many ways, but we had formulated some sort of structure for how our future would be. Moth had found that actually walking improved his health in ways that he'd been told were utterly impossible.
Incredible.
And that he had gained strength as we'd walked, rather than losing his mobility as we'd been told he would. Because the doctors had told him, you know, just don't get too tired and be careful on the stairs. So we walked.
So we decided to scale some cliffs instead.
Exactly.
And he's still fit and well now?
Well, he has spells when he's really not been as well as he was when we finished the path. But but when he gets on a real low, we pack the rucksacks and go for a walk.
What a wonderful thing to have, that you can go and go out and make yourself feel better.
Yes, yeah, and that's at the moment, that's the only treatment that we have, so we keep doing that.
But it's wonderful, I think what's lovely is that you've bought extra time together somehow by going on your mission that still sounds absolutely crazy to me. I mean, I admire it so much, but I know I could never have done it.
I'm sure you could.
Oh no, I'd have been a holy nightmare.
Didn't have somebody picking you up in the evening. You would do it. I know you would.
Yeah, I'm not one of the world's campers.
Tell me about camping.
Yeah. No, yeah, I would do one of those lovely safari tent things, you know.
Not a good little green thing.
Oh, do like a duvet, you know.
Yeah, quite posh for myself.
So tell me about you decided to write about your journey, and, you know, so many people have read the beautiful book that ensued. That must have changed your world in ways you never could have expected. For a start, the love and enthusiasm for the book must have really struck you.
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote the book. It wasn't really a book for people to read. I wrote it for Moth, because I wanted to make a record of that walk, because it seemed so important to us.
Yeah.
And he was starting to lose his memory of bits of it, so I wanted to capture it and keep it for him, so that when he did start to forget it, I could put it in front of him and say, you know, look what we did. Remember, we did, you know, keep trying. You've got to keep trying.
But instead,
yeah, my daughter, before he did, and she said, yeah, Mum, you ought to do something with this. And then eventually I did. Yeah.
So life changed you for a lot. And maybe I'm guessing has given you a lot of security that that didn't ever look possible for you when you were writing it.
I can certainly pay the rent now, which, you know, is always a pleasure.
Yeah, that always feels good.
You have to pay your bills, but I can pay my bills now, and it always makes me smile when I pay the electric bill. Something not quite right about that, is it?
No, I think there's huge gratitude. My husband, before I met him, had been made sort of effectively homeless when he was in his late teens, and he was thrown out of home.
Yeah.
And he ended up in a sort of very difficult financial situation where he, you know, had court judgments because he was 16 and trying to rent a flat with no money. And I remember when we were first together, he appreciated so many things that everybody else takes for granted. Like when we owned our first washing machine, he'd go in and say goodnight to it every night. And I think it's really good to feel like that about the world around you. You know, it's there's great gratitude there.
Yeah. I think that will never leave me. I think it's really sort of ingrained in me now, that that sense of knowing that now things are different. I don't stop feeling lucky or extremely grateful more than anything.
Even for ordinary things.
Yeah.
And you've become a fantastic advocate for homelessness. An advocate for homelessness sounds terrible. You've become an advocate for people who become homeless, I should say.
Well, I think it's really important because it's very easy for many people to regard homeless people as just a problem in the doorway rather than the individuals with the individual stories that they are. I've been given this incredible platform, which a book does, which are in itself was a bit of a surprise, but you know, if I don't talk about homelessness in that situation, then I feel as if I'm letting people down, because I would have hoped when I was homeless that people would be trying their best to raise awareness, if nothing else.
Absolutely. And it's so, yeah, it's an obligation in lots of ways, but a kind of warm obligation to be able to use your voice.
Oh, absolutely. To be able to actually do something, if it's only to change one person's opinion of what homelessness is, then that's a step along the way to actually solving the problem. I mean, we've just been through this incredible time when we did actually solve the problem of homelessness.
Yes, yeah.
Just for those few short weeks, we did not have a homeless problem.
Incredibly quickly as well.
Which just goes to prove that it is absolutely doable, and it is all about prioritising and what we as a country prioritise.
Yeah, so important.
So now all those homeless people who have found shelter and they've found some sort of structure to their days are very, very shortly going to be back out on the street. Back to square one.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, that we have the tools to solve these things and yet we choose not to, essentially. There's no other way to think about it, I don't think.
But this time has shown good. It was always solvable and it was always possible to solve it virtually overnight. Yeah. But we chose not to.
Yeah. And we go on doing that.
And we've chosen to put them back out in the streets. And that's a low point for anyone who's made that choice, I think.
Hear, hear. So to finish, you were due to release a new book in the middle of lockdown and you've decided to delay it. But that's coming in September?
Yes, September the 3rd. It should have been April, but due to lockdown and the amount of publicity that was booked for the months after release. Book, it just wouldn't have been possible. Yes, it's September the 3rd, but I'm quite excited about that, really. It's really a book that's called Wild Silence, and it follows on, really, from the Salt Path. So although it seems like idyllic to find yourself going from homelessness into a home again, I found it quite a difficult adjustment. And it's coming to terms with that adjustment in life and a really sort of closer look to our connection to the natural world and how that's informed our lives and is now forming our future.
Yeah.
That's not bad without giving too much away, is it?
That's very good. Yeah, you said you couldn't give too much away, but that sounds absolutely amazing. And it strikes me already that you're talking about those wintering moments that take you by surprise, I guess. Those times when you think everything should be fine, and they're often the bits that take you down the most.
Exactly. And that's a real parallel with your book Wintering.
Because we're always on slightly the same wavelength, you and I think.
So we'll have to have a chat about the next one when we get off.
Yeah, no, I'm not telling you anything.
Yeah, I think those moments in life when you expect everything to be okay and they're unexpectedly not okay can be really hard to work your way through. And I think this book is about one of those moments and the strength of the natural world to pull you through, and how we are all really closely connected to the natural world, whether we recognise it or we don't.
Oh, Raina, it's been so lovely to speak to you, and I cannot wait to read it. I will be first in line at Waterstones in September, if indeed Waterstones is open by then. we can all hope, right?
Fingers crossed.
But I look forward to us sharing a stage on a literary festival talking about having written a very similar book again.
I know it is. Thank you, Kathleen. It's been lovely to talk to you again.
Thank you so much. And that's just about all for this week's show. Raina's book, The Wild Silence, is out in September. I could have spoken to her forever about the Southwest Coast Path. If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please subscribe, like, or award it some stars, whatever your particular podcast app lets you do. I'll be back next week speaking to another writer who's wintered. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.